stick out, check out, stick out. Help, help.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, I hope you haven't given up on me getting a podcast out this week, and to be perfectly honest, I didn't think I'd get this one out myself. I've been kind of under the weather, so to speak, ever since posting my last program. And once the pain and agony part was over, I was left with practically no energy, and I've been kind of lethargic these past few days. So when I finally fired up my computer and logged into the net this morning, it wasn't with the expectation that I'd get a podcast out today. But then I checked my email, and I'd had a whole bunch of wonderful emails from some of our fellow saloners waiting for me. And on top of that, I discovered that several of you have very generously made donations to keep these podcasts coming. And so now I'm fired up once again, and I'll keep them coming. So my thanks go out to all of you who have written, and especially to Janice Gate Creative, James H., Jason H., John M., Michael, better known as A Dime Short, William R., and Bailey, otherwise known as Beaded Bohemian. And I also want to thank Yarov. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Yarov sent a donation last February, and while I thanked him in an email, I don't think I remembered to mention him in one of the programs. Sorry about that, Yarov. I very much appreciate your support. In fact, the generosity of all of you touches me deeply. So much, in fact, that you have succeeded in restoring my energy to the point where I once again feel like coming back here to the salon to be with so many of my good friends. I guess one of my motivational issues is that there's so much to talk about regarding some of the comments our fellow saloners have sent in that I just kind of keep putting off recording this week's program until I feel more like talking for a while. So I'm going to get back up to speed in stages, and by that I mean I'm right now going to take the easy route and play the second tape from the June 8th trialogue with Terence McKenna, Ralph Abraham, and Rupert Sheldrake. The tape runs about an hour and 20 minutes, but I'm only going to play part of it right now, and then I'll finish it off in a shorter supplemental podcast in a few days, where hopefully I'll quit procrastinating and also read some of the interesting emails I've been receiving. So let's get to it and join the merry trialoggers in yet another of their famous conversations.
Monday, June 8, 1998, 2-ish in the afternoon, trialogue number 2. Okay.
Family fields. I'm interested, as you know, in the fields of social groups, flocks of birds, schools of fish, and packs of wolves, groups of human beings. And I think all of these have morphic fields. And I think that the morphic fields underlying schools of fish, flocks of birds, insect colonies, help organize the movements of the different animals within them. And the ones in packs of wolves enable them to keep in contact with each other over many miles. I think these fields underlie the telepathic bonds between wolf and wolf, or between separated animals and other separated animals, and the same things apply in the human realm. Telepathy mainly occurs in the human realm between mothers and daughters, sons, parents, children, close friends, lovers, and the great majority of spontaneous telepathic cases do not involve guessing Xena cards in darkened rooms, but rather feeling of a sense of emergency by a mother. She calls home and the child's had an accident. Someone feeling a sudden disturbance and suddenly flash about somebody, feeling they're in great distress or some sense of alarm, it turns out they've died. This kind of thing. This is true of dogs and cats too. It's mostly to do with these sorts of feelings that telepathy is involved, emergencies, alarms and so forth, rather than with the transfer of visual information for its own sake. Anyway, these fields I think underlie all social groups, and in the dog and owner thing, I'm looking at the fields between pets and their owners. But when we look at human families, these fields should also be at work in a human family. It would be a classic example of a social field. In chimpanzee groups, in horse groups, these live as family groups usually, female with children and an associated male. Sometimes young males live free of the social group. In many species they do, but they're very often family-based groups. Horse groups, usually no more than about five in wild and feral horses. Wolf packs are usually a female with her cubs and a male, and then some sort of grown-up, more grown-up wolves, but they're family groups. And so in human family groups, we'd expect the same kind of morphic field. Now, this is rather a general and abstract kind of consideration, but it would mean that family fields with their morphic fields would have a kind of memory from the families that contributed to them. The father and mother's families of origin would come together in a family. You'd have the husband and wife, the father and mother. You've got a fusion of family fields coming together into a given family one with their histories and patterns. And in fact, a whole science or therapy or practice of family fields has been worked out in recent years in Germany by what I think the most interesting therapeutic person I've come across for a long time, Bert Hellinger. Have you heard of Hellinger?
No.
H-E-L-L-I-N-G-E-R. Hellinger's work is extremely well known in Germany and has a large influence, and there's a great deal of interest in his work. He has people following his methods and so on. Hellinger used to be a Benedictine. He then went, or perhaps as a Benedictine, went to Africa, where he spent a long time living with the Zulu. And although he says this isn't the direct influence on his therapy, the sense of the ancestral connection that the Zulu have, the more traditional people have, the role of the ancestors, is a major part of his therapy. Anyway, I've been to one of his things in London, and I'm meeting him again soon, and I've become quite friendly with him and his followers, because the main theory they use to try and understand what's going on in these family fields is morphogenetic fields, morphic fields. They think it's the different theories or models. They think it's
He's a therapist of human families,
yes,
or what?
Yes, human families. Mm-hmm. They think this is the most appropriate kind of model. You need a field that links the members of the group together, and there has to be a kind of memory in it. That's what they want, and that's what their family fields are. And morphic fields are that. I mean, there may be other fields that could perhaps give the same effect. But anyway, so that's why I was interested in their work and their interests in mine. And I have been to their, and I've been very impressed by Hellinger's work. How it works is that you have somebody who comes and they present their problem, they tell Hellinger. This is done in a group with a lot of people in a kind of audience. And they say what their problem is and why they're upset or disturbed or something. And then he asks them to constellate their family field. And what that means is that he asks them, your mother, your father, how many brothers and sisters, and so forth. Then he says, now please pick anyone to be your mother. And they pick someone from your, and pick anyone to be your father, they pick them. Your brothers and so on, the members of their primary family and their family of origin. And then he asks them to arrange them in order, place them. And when they
on
place...
The stage,
on the
sitting
stage,
in chairs and sort
no,
of tableau.
Standing. It's like a tableau, yes. Mm-hmm. And when they do that, you get the most interesting things. You see how some people are placed close to each other, facing each other. Some are placed on the periphery, sort of facing away from the rest of the family. And these people can make models. Each one is completely different and quite surprising, these models. Mm. I saw two or three days of this and a whole series of different family models. And you see these extraordinary patterns, which immediately, for the person there, this is their best representation of the family field from the family they come from. But when you see this, it's a whole gestalt, like a snapshot of a system of relationship, who's close together, who's further away, who's facing whom, who's related to whom. And sometimes this is so obviously sort of dispersed and not in relationship, but then the question is, how did, if that one's right out there sort of facing their back to the rest, I mean, what's happened, why are they there, not sort of closer to the others, and what dynamics are involved in this whole family group. And in order to understand that, he often has to go to the family of origin as the father or the mother in the family field. So then he'll ask the person to constellate the father's family field, for example. And then, you know, they pick someone to be the father, and then if the father had two or three brothers, the brothers and the father, the parent, and they have to put them where they were. And sometimes they don't know that well, so they have to guess, but they constellate this field. And it often turns out that the pattern in that first family field and mirrored in the second one, you can just see it in front of you, and there's similar patterns. It sometimes happens that something extraordinary happened in the first field. Say, for example, an uncle drowned as a boy. You know, a 10-year-old boy in that family was killed, drowned in a pond. And then they often leave them out. And he then says, was there anybody in this family that died as a child or that died at birth? Quite often they say yes. He says, find someone, put them in. And very often the whole imbalance in the field is rectified when the missing member is put in, even if it's, say, someone who committed suicide or a child that died in infancy in a previous family field. Unacknowledged members of the group cause grave distortions to the system, and his method, by putting them in, creates a whole field sort of can be rearranged. He then rearranges these fields so what would happen if sensei was brought in? He asked the person, bring them into there, and then in the father's field ask them to acknowledge the child that died and put them in, and then the child, they say, we acknowledge you. The people actually say, we acknowledge you, and then they put the child that died in the right order of children, right in their place between the firstborn, the secondborn, the thirdborn, because the order of birth has a huge impact on these fields and the number of siblings. So here you have a system practically used by Hellinger and his followers, a fascinating thing. And when you see these missing members and the field constituted, and then the family of origin of the person, that field is sort of readjusted. To see a whole field pattern and their role within a field pattern is incredibly therapeutic and releasing for a lot of people. They see that a lot of problems they thought were just their problems are actually their relations to this whole field of interaction in the family. So they take seriously a field model of this process, and with these sort of tableau representations one can see this. And so that made me think, whatever the merits or demerits of Hellinger's system, which I think is very interesting and apparently very effective, the idea of making models of family fields seems to me something that one could address in a more general sense, because there would be certain patterns of dynamics you'd expect if you have a family consisting of mother, father, and then one child, the simplest ones, 2, 3, 4, 5. What kinds of flows of energy? Some of this would be kind of common sense, you know, eldest children and in relation to second children. Most people have had two children say that the eldest ones were more troubled as babies, hard to deal with, the younger ones are somehow much easier to get on with. And more. But then you get this kind of rivalries growing up, sibling rivalries and so on. Then families, more complex family fields where you have stepfathers or stepmothers, stepbrothers and sisters, then you get, on his stage, that you get these very complicated family fields. What happens in those? In real life, those are common nowadays. So one could make certain models of these fields. One could also see how the balance of energy. If you have a field model like this and you take someone who's in the model, move them further away in whatever space you've modeled in, and turn them to face out from the rest of the family, what kind of dynamics happens there with the rest of the family? What happens to them in any group into which they enter, any new family they form? What effect does this have? One could perhaps model this kind of thing. So I wanted to suggest that maybe it's possible to make this family field thing more scientific, investigate it further, make models, and in some way perhaps come up with tests or empirical studies that could further the science or investigation of family fields.
Well, that certainly sounds very interesting. I'm not sure I understand to what degree the use of the word field is justified here. And do they think of like an extended spatial field, like the gravitational field or something is associated with the family, and the individuals have a field like a vibrating aura or something? Or does it just mean the field in a general sense that could be described, let us say, just by giving for any two individuals in the family some strength of the connection, or plus or minus or something, that would be represented in the tableau when the actors are placed on the stage by the geographical distance to them or something, so that bringing one member in closer would correspond in this model to just strengthening the bandwidth of the communication channel or the positivity of the regard or some other like simple parameter. Mm. That would be a more of a connectionist model with like a undirected graph with nodes and links and so on. Is it like links between the people could be just represented by a number, or would it be essential in order to understand the experiences of Helmer to actually have a kind of extended three-dimensional spatial field around each individual that has memory and so on?
Well, maybe a connectionist thing with nodes would be an adequate model. But then you could say that what the connections, the nodes, you could just sort of draw a line around the whole thing and say this was a set of connections or something, which would be perhaps just a different way of trying to model the field. You see, the connections, insofar as you draw, say there's a connection AB and it has a given strength, you're presupposing an invisible bond between people. Yes. That would work when the other person is in the next room, at the very least. And therefore you're proposing a bond which whose reality is not physical in the normal sense, it may be mental, emotional, psychic, I mean whatever word you choose, but it's not sort of smell, touch, hearing, I mean those are involved if you're in the same room. And so the advantage of the field model is it frees you up from thinking that the connections must be normal face-to-face communication, but then they can still exist even if you're apart.
I see, so the family field, the flock, the school and so on is kind of a extrapolation backwards of psychic pets into more of the psychic bonds in the wild.
Well, I think that the bonds even between members of the family, you know, when people go away and they want, like me, I mean I'm attached to my family, so from here I feel a strong need to ring up my children to speak to them as they're going to bed, even though I'm 6,000 miles away. That bond is a strong bond for me. And well, so, and for most people, if they're nearest, yeah. These bonds are not severed by getting on an aeroplane. So whatever model you have of the connections have to be of such a nature that they still persist.
Well, I'm suggesting to whatever the model is, to have the same model as the model we have for the psychic pets, because ethologists, or say these therapists, like the animal equivalent of Hellinger, that analyze cats, for example, they describe the relationship of the cat to the owner person as a form of the relation of the cat to the cat's mother that's been replaced. The cats, even as they age, regard themselves as kittens, as it were, with the owner as the mother cat. The way they play and rub against you and so on is all derived behaviors from what the cat version of Hellinger would describe as the family field on the cat
yes.
level. And therefore, if we are, as we have been thinking about mathematical models for the field that describes the attachment of the cat and the owner, then we would be tempted to use the same model for the family field. In the human family, for example, or flock of
yes.
sheep and so on. And that would be then some kind of, well, telepathy is the word, I think, or a non-specific communication channel between people or animals at a distance.
Yes, although telepathic communications wouldn't need to be passing between at all. And maybe a connectionist model would be fine,
yes.
as long as you leave open the nature of the connection, so that the connection is doesn't have to be presupposed to depend on normal sensory communication. And probably
in a neural net, if you took one of the, and it was capable of, say, parsing natural speech or something, and then you took one of the nodes out or broke one of the connections, and wouldn't be able to do that anymore. So this the connectionist model might be adequate for modeling this Hellinger strategy of bringing in the missing sibling or something, replacing the node and the connections which make a functional unit.
Yes. Mm. Or what would have happened is when before the sibling died, the family field had a different structure because it included that sibling. If the death of the sibling changes the field, but his point is unless it's acknowledged, and unless in some sense the ancestors are acknowledged, and unless the dead sibling is acknowledged and recognized within the field. Their presence within the field is recognized. Their unrecognized presence can cause terrible disturbances. So it's something to do recognizing a kind of virtual node in the field.
I don't see how that would be, I don't know how to model that. How could that be important? What does this recognition consist of? So you are a fish. Okay, now you're, I've recognized you as a fish. Is it, would...
They're coupled oscillators. And the family thing works because people really are complex chemical systems with genetic affinities. You could even suppose a kind of physical mechanism. I mean, they are coupled oscillators that impart their waveform to the local space, which encounters the waveforms of these other oscillators, which are very similar to them physically, more similar to them than any other person or thing. And so there's a kind of entrainment. Often the things are these feeling-toned, something has happened to someone, or I should call someone. So it indicates they are like coupled oscillators.
So the recognition, the non-recognition means, well, the oscillators are coupled, and therefore this one is, and then it's not understood because we're not aware of it. My father's sister, Carrie, died when he was young, so she was never even a person, she was not real. If I had interactions with a place in some structure, say our family field where she belonged, but I didn't acknowledge it, then I would always be confused about what's going on in my life, something like that.
Yes, because the whole structure of the family field is, you see that if it had, or you see there's a kind of memory in these fields, and so the field and the dynamics of the field are influenced by the memory.
Oh, I see it, yes.
Of the person who was there but no longer there. And so the memory is actually working in the dynamics of the field because all these fields have this kind of memory. But if you don't recognize it's there, you don't understand what's really going on in the interactions. And you're always in the dark as to why certain puzzling conflicts or whatever, or suicides. Yeah. There are cases where, amazing cases, where you get members of families, young people, commit suicide in a way that mimics the unacknowledged death of an ancestor, like suicide by drowning, when an ancestor one or two generations before has committed suicide by drowning, but they've never been told about it because it's never acknowledged. And you get these extraordinary patterns that repeat, sometimes literal ones like that, other times sort of morphed ones.
Well, maybe we have to think of different models for the same thing, so that there'd be a model like a connectionist diagram of a family as it were, and then there's another drawing for the family as I see it, and that if I haven't acknowledged my Aunt Carrie, then in my model of the family there's nothing there.
That's right.
But in this other model of actual interactions and so on, it is there. Maybe we need a directed graph where the channel between you and me, for example, would have two lines, one going that way as you and I speak or send you a message, and another one going this way.
Yes, they'd have to be. The connections would have to have sort of directed both directions.
So there could be, in the case of a family member who's not acknowledged, that there's a directed line from that one to me because I'm receiving but not knowing.
Yes.
And then I'm sending nothing back because I'm not acknowledging.
Yes.
So that the acknowledgement of a missing family member would just consist of the addition into the model of one link going back.
That's right. That would be enough. And in his therapeutic workshop, I mean, where he does this for the family, and their whole therapy of the particular person may last half an hour, three quarters of an hour, with constellating these fields. And then in these things, he asks the person to come, say that the members of the family have, there's somebody representing them, you see, in the family field. There's somebody standing in for themselves. They're sitting outside it with him.
Oh.
So say that it was your family field, you choose someone to represent you.
Oh, I see.
So there'd be Ralph in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're sitting back and telling him, you now see Ralph in relation to the others from outside. And then you see how
it's remodeling.
It's remodeling.
Yes.
And then you see the other ones, and he readjusts the field and puts in the absent or unacknowledged members. And then he asks the members actually standing there to acknowledge the unacknowledged ones or whatever. And then he asks you to go and stand in the position of Ralph in this remodeled field and turn to the unacknowledged one and say, you are my aunt, I acknowledge you. and turn to the others and so on, and experience that new constellation from within. And this has a dramatically changing effect on family fields. It brings them to consciousness, it recognizes these things, and the acknowledgement is done, and it changes them. So any model of the fields, you see, would mean the kind of thing you were saying would still apply. You'd have a model of the fields, otherwise you have a map of its perceived today.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're able to bring about the remodel, or at least bring your model of the mm-hmm. field into much more into place, connection with
yes.
what the field actually is,
well, that's
or
excellent.
Was, so then this has a therapeutic effect.
This is the opposite of institutional therapy, where people go into a corporation, for example, which has an actual structure, and then the directors have the model, and instead of changing the model to fit the actuality, they change the actuality to fit the model.
Yes. But they're in a company where you can actually have a board model of flow diagram of power. I mean, these are sort of artificial organizations. But family organizations, although there's a kind of archetypal model, like the nuclear family model or something like that, so those are sort of idealized models, socially approved and recognized. Each family is different, and each is different in its own way, to paraphrase Tolstoy. Anna Karenina. Every happy family is the same, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. So there's
and
a sense
out of shape, as it were, as
yes,
a framework.
The field is somehow distorted or mm-hmm. whatever. So his model, any model were made, would have to take into account those two things. So it's a question of how far can one just say, well, this is an interesting therapy, it's just one among many, and it's just this is its particular trip. But how far can one take seriously the idea that family dynamics are not an arbitrary invention of having there an obvious reality, and we don't have adequate models for these family systems, nor the influence of ancestors within them, which my interest in morphic resonance makes me very keen on, the fact that there must be this historical memory, habit dimension in them.
Well, then the network can be extended indefinitely. It's simply that people outside the family but in the neighborhood or in the past are weakly coupled.
Important teachers in primary school.
Yes.
Things like that.
That sort of thing. They're weakly coupled, yes.
Yes.
And then you can have the way that a given... You could then extend this. Arnold Mendel is the person who's pioneered this model in non-family groups. Are you familiar with his work?
Mm-hmm, I am.
You know Arnold Mendel. But in his book, The Year One, he talks about the modelling of social groups, how you have a social group and that each social group is a kind of organism. And therefore there will be different roles taken up by different people within the group. And in lots of groups, for example, there will tend to be somebody who's a grumbler or a complainer, and who sort of focuses and vocalizes the sort of grumble, takes on the role of making complaints, which other people in the group might be too shy or too restrained to make, but somehow they're made. And then they can also project onto the grumbler a kind of negativity or hostility. This is a dynamic that happens within groups, and quite often, if one grumbler leaves the group or is expelled, someone else has to take on that role of being a grumbler. So he has a kind of field theory, what I'd call a field, I don't know if he calls it a field theory, but I'd call it a field theory of groups, which is less interesting than Hellinger's, in the sense that Hellinger has this family dimension, this time dimension, with innumerable in examples. He has hundreds of videos of his doing this with different family groups. You can see one after another of these groups before your eyes on video. They're very interesting. But Mendel is a more abstract theory based on him working with groups in therapy sessions or in town meetings or workshops. We've got 30 people for a few days. It doesn't have the same kind of historical depth, but it's still dealing with the same kind of group model.
Well, the idea of memory, then Hellinger's interest in memory in the field concept has to do with having the ancestors in the tableau. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, how do you understand the influence of an acknowledged or unacknowledged ancestor, generation or two back on this, the part of the family unit that consists of the currently living members? How to understand that? If it was, say, two generations back, we'd never met. What's the difference?
Well,
how do you understand it?
Well, because say when you have a partner, you get married or not married, as the case may be, you have children, you then have a family field, and assuming the parents are together, your expectations of the way you behave to your children, no one's ever trained you how to raise children. It was never mentioned at school. So how do you know how to treat your kids? Well, the only model you've got is either looking at friends doing this, but the one that runs deepest for you is what happened in your own family. And so you bring to the situation a kind of memory of the whole dynamics of your family of origin. And the same goes for your wife or your partner or the mother of the children. She brings to it the dynamics from her whole family of origin. You and she then have different expectations of how the family is going to work, because you've got two different kind of fields, and she may expect quite different things of you and of the way you treat the children and of the kids than you expect of her and of the kids and so on. And this can either lead to some kind of compromise. In fact, over time, somehow it has to accommodate in some way, but it can also lead to a lot of conflict because there are different models and expectations. So you bring these fields with you, as it were, unconsciously, because they're the fields in which you were in that group there with the sort of field pattern. You're now in a new family group, and you bring that field pattern in, and it sort of fuses with that of your partner. But that's the only, you can learn from other models, you can know other families, you can live with other groups, but basically you bring it with you.
So then do you think cross-cultural marriages are more fraught than marriages within class and cultural domains?
Well, that would be an empirical question. You know, one would predict that there would be certain kinds of problems. Say you take marriages between English people and Indians or Pakistanis, then you could do a model, the Hellinger-type model of the Indian family field. You know, you could interview Indians, look at Indian family structures. They'd probably have quite different sort of expectations mm-hmm. and field patterns from the people from nuclear families growing up in suburbs in England mm-hmm. or America. And if that's the case, you could actually predict what would happen when you put these two, what kinds of conflicts are likely to result, what kinds of expectations the man and woman from these different kinds of backgrounds are going to have within this. And you could talk to people who deal in marriage counselling with mixed marriages and see whether these are indeed the kinds of recurrent problems they encounter. So you could, by talking to sociologists, social workers and people who actually deal with dysfunctional families of various kinds, or functional families, this would be an empirical study on family dynamics from different backgrounds. So you could actually approach it all, you could make models, and you could actually test them, because there's all different kinds of families and fields coming together.
So I think the model then of the family field would have to consist of more than the nodes and the connections and so on. I mean, the creation of the tableau with the patient as the director includes not only where the actors are standing, but also which direction they're facing.
Yes.
And maybe their posture or any kind of a body language representation, facial expression, things like that?
Yes. Well, it doesn't usually, it can involve posture.
Because when we think of animal behavior in the sense of how you raise your children and so on, and there are many, many attributes of a node, an individual member of the family, and their attitude of servitude, or their willingness to sacrifice, compromise, and all these things that we know varies from culture to culture, and mm-hmm. so on. They call the roles, the division of labor of the mother and father, and so on. The father drives the other species of birds away from the nest, and so on. So some kind of modeling or even a simple representation of these behaviors would have to be attached, otherwise the model would be too simple to really indicate the difference between different generations and people from different families coming from different family groups marrying and so on.
Yes, well, it might
help. The geometry wouldn't be enough.
Well, it might help in starting these models with different species of birds, for example. where you've got more standardized patterns and where you can actually observe what happens. Because there is a division of labor with birds, and say a gander will defend the nest of the goose and young. Sunbirds, cuckoos, do it a totally different way, of course, and the baby cuckoo is like a pathology in the nest of other birds. So there are all different patterns among birds in the division of labor, but they're fairly consistent within the species. So if one had a model that would work for these, the family fields are more complicated. Human family situations are far more complicated than those of many animals. And the beauty of looking at bird families is that you could have 20, 30 different kinds of behavior already documented by naturalists. The family life of different birds, the number of little birds they have, the way they teach them to fly, whether they have social groups or not, like flocks. Some birds have flocks, some don't. There'd be a lot of scope. Anyone who could come up with a good model would have a large amount of natural history at their feet as territory to explore with this modelling technique. Because right now, the kinds of models that ethologists have of groups are not terrible. Well, their focus has been distorted by the Richard Dawkins type people, where it's all the selfish genes and it's seen as individual competition and struggle. And maybe that perspective has something to offer to this modelling process, but it hasn't led to any kind of emphasis or attempts to model the dynamics of these groups very effectively.
The other thing you have to take into consideration is a family is an organism evolving through time. The arrangement, the tableau, is a snapshot in time. Mm-hmm. It also, I mean, one could assume it's the patient or the client's relationship to their family at the present moment. But on the other hand, if you're going to bring in ancestors, is the ancestor influencing the field in as a child, as a middle-aged person, as an elderly person? Did their influence on the field change through time? Mm. And then there seems to be sort of a dichotomy. There's a static now, but it's being modified by a shifting past as these ancestors exert differing influences on the situation depending on where in their own life history they are.
Yes, and in some tribal cultures, like the Sora in India, this is the kind of thing ancestors, you know, the role of the ancestors has actually been documented by anthropologists. There's a whole body of anthropological data here. There's the Sora, where my friend Piers Vitebsky was an anthropologist, and where I visited him in the field in Bihar. In Orissa, in Koraput district of Orissa. He was living in the Sora village. He was living with the Shaman. And they had a whole very complicated doctrine about what happened to you when you died. Say you died by suicide, you went to the sun. If you died of smallpox, you went to a kind of leopard spirit. And there were different groups. And the ancestors who died of that all went to the same place, so you were with them. And you wanted to get the living into your group when they died, rather than someone else, because you wanted to be with them. So there were always competing death spirits, different modes of death, containing ancestors, competing for the living.
Mm.
And one of the best ways to deal with this is to make peace with them, and to make offerings. Every year there's these buffalo sacrifices for the ancestors. So if you give blood and appease the ancestors, then they'll be happier and they won't feel so needy, and they're not going to try and grab you so much, and so you buy them off. But after two or three generations, their individual identity, their names begin to fade, and they're sort of liberated over time from that sort of obsessive thing until the souls are sort of set free, at which time they become butterflies. So when you see butterflies flying around you in the forest or in the village, these are the liberated souls of distant ancestors whose influence is no longer particularly important in this whole economy of death and recruitment.
Hmm.
Well, this is the memory model for the conspiracy theorists.
Yes, except that there's lots of different... It's like a competing... It's not so much conspiracy... Well, there are sort of competing conspiracies.
Yes.
And there are certain stones you can trip over in the forest, and there are certain ones that catch people who stumble and make you stumble in the forest. But you have to be on good terms with the ancestors. And what being on good terms with them above all means acknowledging them. It means in a sacrifice of buffalo blood that you name and acknowledge the key ancestors. Mm-hmm. You acknowledge all the dead in your lineage. And if you miss anyone up, they're going to be angry. And if they're angry, that means trouble.
So this is their cosmology, the way they see it. And each tribe, each group has its own theory of the ancestors. The Japanese and Chinese, especially the Chinese, have an elaborate sense of the role and importance of the ancestors, with all these offerings they make of paper houses and whatnot. And I think one, if one were looking at this empirically in the human realm, I mean, one would perhaps have models for different species of birds, but coming back to the human realm, to compare the dynamics, which you could do partly from anthropology and partly from modern sociology, of, say, Chinese families, typical Chinese families where there's a high degree of acknowledgement of the ancestors, with modern American families or Western families, fragmented, dissociated, chaotic, where there's a very low degree of acknowledgement of the ancestors, and see what kinds of patterns occur there. And then you could look at Chinese Americans who may have abandoned all the ancestor worship thing and just assimilated to mainstream American society. Do they have particular qualities, or do they just become like Americans?
Well, they stumble a lot.
They stumble a lot.
They must, because a lot of angry ancestors were accustomed to a greater degree of...
Well, you'd expect that, you see, but then it maybe they go on acknowledging them. A lot of the Chinese are very traditional. So, you know, there's a whole field of research here, the role of the ancestors, because every culture has its own way of dealing with them and its own way of acknowledging them. And in the Christian tradition, the festival of All Hallows and All Souls, Halloween is the eve of All Hallows, November the 1st, and All Souls Day, November the 2nd, is when requiem masses are offered for all the dead, all the departed, in which you can particularly hand in the names of particular ancestors or particular people who don't have their names read out at the requiem mass. So I do this myself. So there's an acknowledged social form in our culture for acknowledging and naming the ancestors in a traditional ceremony. So there are great variations in our own culture between the degree to which people within different families and traditions acknowledge the ancestors. The Roman Catholics do it more than the Protestants, because of this phenomenon of requiem masses and the observance of All Souls Day, which Protestants don't observe. So it's a rich field for investigation, you see, in sociology, anthropology, model building, etc., but as yet more or less unexplored.
Do you think these ideas could be extrapolated to non-human families with any degree of... that you would learn anything useful?
Yes, it would have to be exactly the same, or perhaps simpler. Like bird families, maybe all the behaviors that we could quantify are ones that ethologists had been traditionally observing, and they might have missed a lot of things, like the role of the ancestors among birds. I don't think they ever noticed. Was the ancestral knowledge, are there any, bird families with three generations? And
I guess you could ask, what is a family? Does an insect have a family?
Well, a termite certainly does, on the
social
scale.
Yes. But for instance...
a social group, it wouldn't have to be a family. Whatever group that you can observe, like you observe a school of fish, you might not know the ancestry or the kinship diagram, but if you could quantify the observables, whatever ethologists observe about birds. The gander is aggressive and attacks other birds, so that would be a number from 1 to 10 of aggression. Then the mother nourishes by going, getting food, chewing it up, spitting it in their mouth, and they'll be nourished. It's another parameter. So whatever the ethologists observe more or less defines the model that they have of bird groups or families, and likewise whatever species have been observed. I don't think there is any mathematical modeling effort that's been going on among ethologists or anthropologists for that matter.
But really this theory is saying that it's genetic similarity impinges on the strength of the bond.
No, I veto
that. It may or may not.
So twins would then be in a special position.
Well, they are in a special position. It's traditionally acknowledged and revealed by modern twin research. They are. But genetic similarity is, you see, but the mother and the father, the children have a genetic similarity to the mother and the father.
Right.
The mother and the father have no necessary genetic similarity. And it's also possible for members of a pack of wolves, you know, a wolf, a male may join a group. So you do have interchange between groups, and exogamy, marrying to a group outside the familiar group is the rule rather than the exception. So although you say that at least one member of the group, the father or the mother, is going to have a different, unrelated genetic nature. So it's not a necessary feature of these bonds to have genetic similarity. They may or may not have it, and it may be they're stronger in the social insects, where you've got all these castes of workers derived from the queen and sharing half the genes of, you know, their sisters with each other. They have a great many genes in common. Yes, this may give a kind of more telepathic type connection between them, but I wouldn't put genetics as our key. It's not going to help us much in this particular
discussion. So can you imagine a strong link between a person and their great-grandfather's second wife, to whom they have no relation other than that?
Oh no, if it's the second wife, it would be relatively irrelevant. And Hellinger, it would, you know, if one were doing this modelling, one would look at what he thinks. It's the family of origin. What would matter is the time when your grandfather was born. The family, his family of origin, it may later include when he's 12, 15, his father marrying again or something, but it would be the origin field you look at
first. I see.
And these later ones have relatively small effect. So, you know, they've already got their ideas about what weightings you'd give to these different people in the drama. But the difference between birds and people is that the general pattern of a bird family is given instinctively. It's by a morphic field, I would say, with such a deep and strong morphic resonance, you've got a kind of basic pattern that the whole species lies within. And if you have a deviant family, subsequent ones would get morphic resonance from their own deviant family of origin. But they'd also get resonance from sort of a huge runnel in creative family life. Now, in the human world, where there's no genetically determined family structure, because it's cultural, a great deal of human cultural evolution is sort of decoupled from genetics, it's the difference between Italian families and Jewish families and English families and American families and stuff, and families in New England and California, is not particularly genetic. It's cultural. And the fact that families have changed through divorce, etc., etc., over the last 100 years, much smaller family sizes. 100 years ago, most of our ancestors would have had 6, 7 siblings. Mine did. Now, you've got much smaller nuclear families, higher rates of divorce, it's changed. And so it's not genetic. It's much too quick. So genetics doesn't really help us much. And that's why in the human realm, the only model that you can rely on is not a genetically inherited model, because we don't have that, whereas animals do. But there's the cultural experience in which you grew up and the cultural models around you. So that's why I think that although one could have a certain class of models that would handle human families and bird families, the human ones are always going to be much more complicated.
Much more complicated, because you'd have to model the cultures as well. So maybe birds are easier because they're monocultural in a sense, but culture is also simpler.
But once a class of models had been built up in one field, it would be a matter of extending it to the other, wouldn't it?
Why it would be easiest to start with the simplest models, simplest cases, and then easily extrapolate upward until you get to human species and eventually to whales and so on.
Is it a metaphor?
I hate to cut this off right here, but my energy levels are running low, and so I'm going to call it a day for now. But I'll get the remaining part of this trilogue out as soon as I can, hopefully in the next few days. I haven't heard the end of this conversation yet myself, but already Rupert has given me a lot to think about along the lines of family morphogenic fields. In fact, it may even open up a whole new line of dialogue between my cousins and myself. At least I hope it will. While I'm thinking of it, I want to say something about the sound quality in some of these podcasts. Believe it or not, I actually do edit the talks I play, and in some cases I've even been successful in cleaning up the sound significantly. But there are some instances, like today's trilogue, that were recorded with a hum in them. And as hard as I tried, I wasn't able to remove that hum without causing a little distortion in the speakers' voices. And so I decided that the hum was less annoying than the voice changes and left it just as it was recorded. Now, I also know that there are, among us here in the salon, quite a few audio experts, like Brian and John H., and I sincerely appreciate your offers of help, and that goes to all of you who have written to offer technical assistance. My problem is that I've got kind of a tiger by the tail here, and I don't want to let go until I fully understand my exit strategy. The tiger, of course, is the Psychedelic Salon. And to be honest, I never really gave any thought to having much of an audience, and so I figured it was a nice hobby that I could drop if I ever got tired of it. But now it's grown into something much more than I expected, and to tell the truth, it's really giving me a problem with what I think of as my main life's work, which is to finish a novel I've been working on for over 4 years now. But don't get me wrong, I'm doing these podcasts because there really isn't anything I'd rather be doing. You writers out there know how easy it is to find something to do other than to do what you came here to do. And I do realize that if I'm ever going to get back to work on my new book, I'm going to have to figure a way to offload some of the back-end work involved in these podcasts and in maintaining several websites. So I've been working on a long-range plan to turn the salon into more of a community project, which, of course, would allow us to bring in more of the work being done by many of our regulars here in the salon. My reason for mentioning this right now is that I know some of you are getting frustrated at my slow response to your suggestions and comments and offers of help, and I hear you loud and clear, and I'm pretty much in agreement with most of your suggestions. But I don't want to make any false steps because we've really got a nice thing going here, you know. When I'm recording these podcasts, I really do feel like I'm sitting there beside you and having a conversation. And I don't want to do anything that will change that feeling for me because if this becomes a job or something I'm not wanting to do most of the time, well, then I suspect that we'll all lose interest in this interesting psychedelic experiment. So my plan is to continue exploring your ideas and come up with some suggestions that we can all kick around until we figure out how to continue growing our connections and exchanging ideas among the worldwide psychedelic community. And sometime after this year's Burning Man Festival, where I hope to kick around some of these ideas in person with you, I'll let all of you volunteers and potential volunteers know what I've come up with once we get back from the burn, and we'll figure out how all of you can become more involved in this fun project of spreading the truth about what I believe to be the only real hope for our species' long-term survival, and that is the hope that comes from increasing our understanding of psychedelic substances. Well, that's a little heavier note than I planned on ending on, but I want to get the first part of this talk out today so you don't think I've disappeared on you, like Queer Ninja has. And hey, Ninja, I hope you're out there in cyberdelic space grooving on some great music right now. We miss your podcast, my friend, but mainly we're worried about you. So if you hear this and you're so motivated, please let somebody know that you're okay. And hey, be well, my friend. Now, before I go, I want to mention, as always, that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 2.5 license. And if you have any questions about that, you can just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can also find at www.psychedelicsalon.org. And if you have any questions, comments, complaints, or suggestions about these podcasts, well, just send them to lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. And thanks again to Jacques Cordell and Wells, otherwise known as Chateau Hayuk, for the use of your music here in the salon. And a big thank you again to Janice Gate Creative, James, Jason, John M., A Dime Short, Yarov, and William. This one was for you guys, because without the boost you gave me this morning, I probably would have put this off for another week. And of course, thank you for being here. I really enjoy the time we spend together here each week, and I know that you probably feel the same way. So for now, this is Lorenzo, signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.